Thanks, Sinead. Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, new homes for hundreds of flying raptors in Sligo. Zookeepers turn their hands to dairy farming. Dark chocolate tales in Wexford and feeling Darth Vader's presence in the Wicklow Hills. Come in out of the rain, under the umbrella, or just pull the duvet over your head. It is not a morning for going out, but it is going to brighten up a little bit later on in the morning. Give yourself just a few minutes of respite this morning with us. Finding that right balance between farming and nature, between putting food on the table and protecting the place that it is produced, is the life's work, as you know, of many people who come on this programme. Farmers are forever learning from each other and improving what they do by looking over the hedge in at the neighbours and then talking about it before taking the plunge. Now, that energy is something that Chagask has tried to tap into in a new knowledge network, is what they call it, focusing on nature on the farm, and they've given it the name Farm BioNet. 30 people have already signed up to participate, including dairy farmers James and Rachel Creighton. Brenda Donoghue visited them yesterday on their farm in Grangebeg on the Wicklow Kildare border.
On this particular pond, we have breeding more hens. We literally just saw three chicks. They've only hatched this morning. And then we also have had teal throughout the winter. We had a pair that were just hanging around for a while there, so I was hoping maybe something might happen, but I haven't seen any evidence just yet. We get herons here sometimes as well, frog spawn. So it's a wonderful place to live. It's a wonderful place to bring the kids up. But we are a dairy farm, and I'd like you to meet some of the calves and the cows that keep this place going.
We're on the way to the calf shed, but you've chosen to get involved in this BioNet project. Why did you choose that?
We chose because we've been involved in protecting farmland pollinators for the last 4 years. We're part of an EIP. We're also hugely supportive of our biodiversity on the farm. We see our farm as more of an ecosystem. We try to farm alongside nature. This farm BioNet gives us an opportunity to contribute to real change throughout Ireland and Europe, and so we want to be part of that change and part of that movement.
Let's take refuge from the rain in your lovely calf shed. Oh, they're so lovely and content.
They sure are. They've had their milk and their feed. These ones down the end here are our Montbelliards. We only just started to get into this breed now, and we're delighted with them. They're beautiful calves.
And helping you out.
And helping us out and running the show, really, is the wonderful James. He's my husband. And we met in Dublin Zoo, where we worked for a long time, and he practically grew up in the zoo. His family are the zookeepers of Dublin.
Were.
The Creightons, James.
The Creightons, the famous ones, or infamous ones, depending on your way of life.
Before I get into all that, James, you left Blanchardstown. You left the confines of the zoo for the wilds of the Kildare-Wicklow border. Why?
I suppose after COVID, we had a kind of reevaluation of family life and where we wanted to go in life. And we sat down and talked about it. And we thought, you know, this could be the right move for the family, our family with our three kids, to come down. And it's a beautiful area. And it was an exciting project. We just grabbed it with both handlebars and just went with it.
But is it a lot different dealing with the animals and the nature here than Dublin Zoo, or is it similar?
Well, it's a lot different in the sense, you know, obviously this is a farm and it's a commercial farm, so, you know, we're in the dairy industry, and but of course we live side by side nature here. Rachel's father Barney and his father before him have done a lot of the groundwork to ensure that nature thrives around here. You know, we've a lot of hedgerows, we've a lot of trees, and we've a lot of species around here. And, you know, it's a big thing that me and Rachel like to do, to see the species. We've got pine marten in the forest, we've got plenty of birds, we have a woodpecker now that's a resident that comes, we've plenty of bat species. So all of that is close to our hearts, that we want to continue to keep safe and enhance and make better, you know. So it's a real balance.
And James, as a Dub, in Kildare. Are you all right?
Sometimes I think, you know, maybe down here has been a little bit wilder than the zoo. But the biggest part for us as well is to see the kids happy, you know, obviously like most parents. And they love it down here. They love their school, their local school. They've got great friends around them. So we couldn't have wished for a better start to a new project.
Rachel, where are we walking to now?
So now we're on our way to our forest. It's a broadleaf forest. It's a hectare in size. It's 30 years old, so I would have been about 8 years of age helping to plant this forest. It's wonderful to see how it has grown and the life that it is supporting as well. And it's a wonderful asset to the farm.
What do you show me on your phone, James?
So this is a camera trap that we set up in the forest here last year. And then you'll see one of Ireland's mammals that was becoming, you know, very rare to see. And that's the pine marten. And so they bred last year in this forest. And
that's
they
them
had kits.
Breeding.
That's them breeding with their kits. And they're being caught in the camera trap. And they've gone off now to obviously go by themselves now. They don't stay with the mum and dad. So they've gone off and live their own life. But it's great to see, because they were a mammal that were very much in decline in Ireland, and now they are really starting to re-flourish, and hopefully going to help our red squirrel population, because they are one of the predators of grey squirrels.
This farm is amazing. Everywhere you hear nature, you see it. But I'm very interested in how both of you met. James, in Dublin Zoo, when did you first set eyes on Rachel, and when was that moment where you went, okay?
Well, we first set each eye obviously in Dublin Zoo, and it was in the elephant habitat. I was a zookeeper already there a couple of years before Rachel came in, and both of us were a little bit strange. I was a real dub, probably a bit rough around the edges. And Rachel kind of came in as a very refined lady from the countryside who sang in a choir and still participated in going to church. And so, you know, we were both probably totally different people. I suppose our friendship grew, and then we kind of both found each other quite interesting, and over time the love blossomed. Here we are now, many years later, married and three children. So, you know, it's kind of similar to the parents. My parents met in the zoo, and my dad was a zookeeper and she worked in the restaurant. They're married over 50 years, so maybe it's a good testament to meeting your partner in the zoo. I don't know. So we'll hope we'll last as long anyway.
James, there's a few details I'm missing. Rachel, when did you first know that it was different with James, that it was more than just that shared interest in the beautiful animals?
I think when he told his mother that this is the woman he was going to marry. I was like, what? I know. He always intrigued me. I found him challenging. I found him funny. He was so different to anything or anyone I had met. And I just felt like, I don't want to be anywhere away from this guy. One of the things that always really impressed me with James is just how he was with the animals, and how he was able to bring the best out of the animals, and how to make them as happy as they could be. If you can really estimate happiness within animals, I suppose it's not a scientific thing, but it is. You can see it. He just has a natural gift for it.
What qualities has that brought to the farm?
The cows, you can see their reaction to him, the calves, how they are with him, and they really thrive under his care. So
there was already a very high standard of welfare when I came, in fairness. Like Barney had run the farm exceptionally well. Welfare has always been a key part of the farm here, so always making sure there's plenty of food on offer and plenty of good bedding. So, you know, it's a very easy thing to take over when you've got, like, you know, the foundations already here.
Rachel, I can see why you absolutely love it here. What an amazing place to bring up your lovely young family. What drives you to get involved in all the projects that you're involved in?
Well, without being too much of a cliche, I suppose my children do, because I want them to have a future. You know, our future often seems bleak because you hear about it, well, you know, all the climate change that's happening, our biodiversity decline. In order to stop myself from going into a bit of a depression over it, I was like, well, we need to do something about it. And we have 180 acres here to do that. Our farm is my ecosystem that I can take care of to give my children a bit of a hope that our nature can be saved.
Brenda there with James and Rachel Creighton. Anyone interested in joining the national network can email farmbionet@chagask.ie for further details. Now, listen to this. Well, this is going to be one oft-heard sound this weekend, but this That's the sound of Easter. Apparently, we eat an average of just over 3.5 kilos of chocolate every year. Much of it, you would imagine, over the course of the coming weekend. And your 3.5 kilos would also cost you an awful lot more now than a few years ago. For about 25 years, cocoa traded at $4,000 a tonne. Then it hit $12,000 a tonne last year before slipping back this year to about $8,000. How has this price yo-yoing affected the growing army of artisanal chocolate producers around the country? Bean and Goose is a bean-to-bar chocolate company in County Wexford, and sisters and founders Natalie and Karen Keane join me this morning. Good morning to both of you. Thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for bringing your product.
No problem.
Hello.
11 years in business. Congratulations.
Thank you.
In that time, though, as I was saying, you've gone from a relatively sustainable, steady commodity price to something with eye-watering inflation, Natalie.
Yep. It's been a huge, huge increase in the price of cacao. So it is having an impact on every chocolate business. For sure.
And the consequence for some has been to reduce the amount of cocoa in their product.
Correct.
Presumably for people like you who are offering something at the higher end of the mm-hmm. value chain, you're not so worried about that. You're just concentrating on the product.
Exactly. So we have always paid high prices for our cacao, and we have always communicated why to the customer. So being a Goose customer has always paid more for a bar of chocolate, and they are showing signs of coming along the journey with us. So we have had to do a price increase ourselves. But we haven't seen a drop in sales. I think the customer understands why they pay more for our bar of chocolate.
Can we, Karen, satisfy ourselves that the people producing the cocoa beans in South America are getting to share in this price inflation?
Yeah, absolutely. And we had the privilege in January to go out to Colombia to meet the growers out there with our partners, Original Beans. And it was just so lovely and so uplifting to see the impact it has on their lives, to be paid correctly, to have the forest looked after, and just their future looked after as well. So it was really lovely.
How much are they getting a kilo?
Our growers are probably getting about €12 a kilo for their beans, which is great to see.
Okay. Now, there are parts of the world where there are growers who are getting €2 or €3 euro a kilo.
There is. Yeah.
So what difference does that make in their lives, that price difference?
It means they can plan for their future. Yeah. It means that they know what's going to be happening 5 years' time, 10 years' time. And you can see, planning for their children's future, schooling. It's just such a great thing to see.
It's mad, though, isn't it, Natalie, that difference between €12 and $12,000 a tonne.
Yes.
Who is it that's getting all of that? How much of it are you getting?
How much are we getting? not a lot. Who is getting that? That's a really interesting question. Well, like Karen said, our farmers are getting a really great income. So that's fantastic. And like Karen said, they're planning for their future. I can't answer the question for the other bigger chocolate brands.
There are many of those brands. Well, sorry, there are plenty of brands that are doing the fair trade and the ethically produced things well. But there are many that have reduced the size of the bars and reduced the amount of cocoa in it. At what point does chocolate stop becoming, or stop being chocolate? What's the level of cocoa that has to be in it?
Yeah, so the EU are very strict on this, actually. So they've got really clear guidelines. And for dark chocolate, it must have at least 35% cacao in it to be declared a dark chocolate product. Milk chocolate is 25% cacao in it. And you're right, a lot of companies are now below that level. So it's no longer chocolate, it's something else.
At the other end of the spectrum, though, we've seen that there are now, with things like Dubai chocolate, these really kind of over-engineered products. Is that the trend now, is to offer, I don't know, is sophisticated the right word, product?
It's indulgent, I think is probably the word. But it does seem to be a trend. But a lot of these trends, and we have tried it, and some of them they're great, they're delicious. But then as a brand like ours, you've got to then weigh up, is that trend, does that trend fit what you do? Does it fit your values, your purpose, your mission? And for us, it doesn't. However, there are beautiful versions of that trend out there for sure.
Why doesn't it fit your your mission?
Right from the beginning, when we've looked at the flavours and things that we do, when we bring the chocolate to Ireland, we like to celebrate Ireland after that. So whether it be our flavours, the producers that we work with, the artwork and things like that. So every bar we create, there's thought behind it. There's a reason why we've created that bar.
There is. There's a lovely story, even in the shape of the chocolate. Yeah. That bar that I did that with earlier on has is that a topographical map on it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's where we started Bean and Goose Chocolate, the Last Tree Farm, just outside.
So that is the contours of the hill of the farm in Gore, in Ferns.
Yes.
Woven into the chocolate.
Yeah, and all of our bars are like that. They've all got, all our bar molds are unique. They celebrate the landscape and nature.
Okay. And the packaging as well. I mean, you are to be commended on having just about zero plastic in that and only cardboard. That presumably, Natalie, something that takes work, because the line of least resistance must be plastic.
It, for sure, yeah. It's very easy to get a plastic packaging solution. We've always been plastic free. So yes, it takes longer, it costs more, it's harder. But that's what our customer would want from their chocolate brand. So it's always worth doing. There's no other way around that for us.
Tell me about the origin story, and don't skip on the part where the two of you spent a year in the kitchen cooking batch after batch after batch, making sure that what you had was the best chocolate possible before going to market.
Absolutely, yeah. So the story began, we've been in business 11 years this year, so the story actually begins 12 years ago. And the idea, we wanted to work together. So we wanted to do something together, and we knew it had to be in food, but that was all we knew at that point. So we were thinking, what could it be? What were we going to bring to life? And then I was doing some work within a sourcing Irish chocolate for another chocolate company. They weren't making it, but they were sourcing it. So I was doing a bit of a deep dive into what was around the Irish chocolate market. And like I said, there are some beautiful brands out there. However, there was no brand at that time that was doing what had been done in the craft beer market, the coffee market, which was creating a product for the new consumer. Okay. So somebody who wanted to give something Irish and be really proud to give something Irish in its flavour, its form, and the sustainability behind it. So that was the starting idea.
And how many batches were there before you were absolutely satisfied, Karen, that you had the right product?
So many.
What did you do to your livers in the meantime?
When we first started, we've got machinery to help us now, but when we first started, we made the traditional way, hand tempering on marble slabs. So myself and Natalie had a marble slab each in my kitchen. Mm-hmm. And we stood side by side making many, many batches of chocolate until we were happy with what we were creating, that we were good enough to call ourselves chocolatiers.
Absolutely.
And then when we got to that point, that's when we went to the farmers markets in Dublin to try and see what the customer thought of what we were doing.
We spent years doing that. We spent 3 years in the farmers markets around Dublin, talking to the customer and really trying to understand what they wanted from this brand. So it was very much built with the customer in mind.
Very good. All right. Natalie and Karen Keane, Bean and Goose, thank you both very much for joining us this morning. And just one more go before I have a little taste during the ad break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
8:30 on your Saturday morning. Good morning to you. If you can't measure it, you can't improve it, is how the saying goes. And because we have 73,000 kilometres of rivers in Ireland, enough to go around the equator twice, we have a bit of a problem in how much measuring of water quality the EPA and the local authorities, LawPro, are actually able to accomplish. UCD had a bit of a bright idea, though. What if we were able to get all of those people who studied science but ended up doing something else with their lives to give up a bit of time to go and inspect our more remote rivers for aquatic life and water quality? I joined a group of them last weekend on the Clahogue River, high in the Wicklow Hills.
My name is Mary Kelly Quinn. I'm from UCD. I live locally and I have been working with a group of citizen scientists for almost 18 months, training them in how to use river microinvertebrates as indicators of water quality.
the bugs and the creepy crawlies to tell us how clean the rivers are.
Absolutely. So we're talking about things like mayflies, stoneflies, caddisflies, and it's the larval stages of those that you find in the river. And the presence of a range of those will give an indication of water quality. So they're given an indication of prevailing water quality. So it's like a video recording of what has gone on in the river over a number of months.
Why are you outsourcing the job effectively to non-academics?
Well, if you think about it, almost 75% of our river network is small streams or headwaters. Very few sites on those rivers are covered in the EPA's National Monitoring Programme. And this is the most, I suppose, vulnerable part of the river network. And so there's a job there for citizen science to keep an eye on how the water quality is doing.
So we have our mayfly isolated in our lovely milk bottle lid, and then we go through our mayfly ID. So we have our flash mayflies, our cylindrical ones, and this looks like it's got a very filamentous gills. So that looks like
How many different kinds of mayfly are there?
There are
pages and pages dozens in your guidebook.
But these have actually been narrowed down to some of the more easier to identify. So this is not even half of it. Dozens and dozens.
Can I take a look at the little one that
yes,
you have
so
there?
If you hold this up to your eye and the lens and point the light onto the gills, you'll see that they're very filamenty.
Oh, look.
You see the way they're in pairs.
He's fascinating.
So that allows them to utilise the oxygen in the water.
When you look at these guys this close up, you can see where the inspiration for all of these science fiction creatures and aliens came from.
Well, that's it. And in fact, one of mine, the stoneflies, I've actually called him Darth Vader, because he's got, when you see him really close up, he's got dark wing buds.
Oh, he's ominous, isn't he? Yeah.
So he has a very sort of sci-fi character to him.
What's your day job? Are you a scientist by training?
Well, I'm an environmental scientist, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I would have studied water pollution in college. Well, I suppose it's kind of marrying my knowledge of environmental science that I would have studied way, way back, and then actually getting out and reminding myself how amazing it is to delve under the water, bring these creatures to the surface and really look at them in detail, and have a crew that are equally enthusiastic. Isn't that right, Laura? So that's the magic. It's finding the people that love the same things as you.
Has anybody else noticed more bugs on their windscreens this year than for quite a number of years?
No, I haven't noticed.
You
that,
have, you have,
that would
Dave.
Be a good sign. Absolutely.
Yes. You have.
Yes.
So it's not just me.
No. Definitely, I noticed over the last week with the really nice weather that I got a lot more bugs on the windscreen, which is a great sign.
And not for the ones that ended up on your windscreen.
No, of course.
but it is generally, isn't it?
Yeah, because, and I had noted that, like, for a number of years, there was far less insects. Like, you know, didn't have a problem with my windscreen getting.
It is almost like the cross-country trips of my childhood now. Mm. You have to have a sponge in the car to clean the windscreen off.
Right, and this is quite early in the year.
Yeah, no, but this is within the last 2 weeks I've noticed this.
I noted that.
So, Dave, show me what you have here.
Yeah, I've managed to get a couple of caddisfly, cased caddis, this one here.
How long did it take you to get your eye in? Because you're looking at a tray full of vegetation and grit and stone, and sometimes these little guys aren't actually really that different to the stuff in the background.
So it does take a number of sessions.
So show me the caddisfly.
So this is a cased caddisfly here, and this is an uncased. And
now, you can the cased caddisfly looks like a twig to me.
Yeah. But it is a case that's made from lots of different pieces of sand. And you can see some of the mica from the granite it glittering on it. So it's quite
that's
interesting.
That's fascinating. So that is where it does its gestating or it's growing up before emerging.
Yes, so they live on the bottom in this case, feeding.
Dave, what's your background?
I studied biology.
Okay.
And this was something that I always wanted to do. So.
But life took you in a different direction.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I've done several different jobs. Some are completely away from what I intended to do. So
this is a way of getting back to something that was obviously a passion. Yeah,
yeah, I'm coming back to. So for me, it's been a long trip, but it's I'm really glad to be doing this now.
There must be so many people out there who did a primary degree in something that they just never end up getting to use that knowledge. So this is really quite a clever way of tapping into that,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely. For me, it's being able to do something that I feel is highly relevant. How sensitive these creatures are and how they're being, we can use them as biomonitors.
These are the canaries in the coal mine.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Metaphorically speaking, yeah.
Yes, yeah, because certain species are more sensitive than others, it gives us a good indication of how pristine or how not the stream is.
Mary Kelly Quinn's band of merry citizen scientists are supported by LawPro, the local authority's water programme. More details of that on LA Waters, local authority waters, lawaters.ie. I live in a rural part of the country where in the next few weeks, 13 years after work began, rural broadband will finally arrive. The whole parish is just slightly dumbstruck by the prospect of it. It has so many echoes of rural electrification to it, something most think is a social good. The majority want it, but there's a slight hesitation about the changes that it might end up bringing. Rosemary Hartigan has been doing some research into that moment of transformation when electricity arrived into farmhouse kitchens for a talk that she is giving next week, which will be going on in the Agriculture Museum in Johnstown Castle in Wexford. And she joins me in studio now. Good morning to you. There was a cast of characters here associated with rural electrification. There's demonstrators, there was adopters, there was installers, and there was backsliders. Who were the backsliders that so many worried about?
Backsliders were people who initially, when the area was surveyed to see if electricity would be taken up by the community, they had signed up. And when the ESB went back in again and went back to their houses, they'd changed their mind.
And the fear was that they would queer the pitch for everybody.
Totally, because the country was divided up effectively using parish boundaries. And the most economically viable parishes were given electricity first. So I'm very focused on Wexford. And in Wexford, the first places to get electricity were down in the very southwest of the county in Shelburne and up in the north of the county in Inch near Gorey, which doesn't make sense really. But they were the places where people
were... Where there was
were,
going to yeah. be the highest rate of uptake. And the social engineering that went on to ensure uptake was absolutely mad. For a start, they were preaching from the pulpit about
totally.
This.
Totally. There was a priest in Tipperary, and I'm sure there were many more, who called names out off the pulpit for people who had let the parish
denounce
down.
Them.
Totally,
from
yeah.
From the pulpit,
yeah.
Good Lord. And the politicians of the day, I mean, not least Sean Lamass.
Yep. He has a great quote in 1945. So rural electrification started off in 1946 with the first pole going up in North County Dublin. But in 1945, he was the Minister for Industry and Commerce. And I'm just going to read this for you because it's class. I hope to see the day when a girl gets a proposal from a farmer. She will inquire not so much about the number of cows, but rather concerning the electrical appliances she will require before she gives her consent, including not merely electric light, but a water heater, an electric clothes boiler, a vacuum cleaner, and even a refrigerator.
Now, it worked, though. I don't know whether he was just following something or setting the trend here, because it became a chat-up line.
Oh, totally. Women would be at dances and they'd say, have you got the electric, before they'd even entertain a man.
So it wasn't just about herd size or road frontage.
No road frontage at that point. We were very far away from the Celtic Tiger.
We all know the immediate consequence of getting the 100-watt bulb in was that people realised how dirty their kitchens were. But there's some really interesting unintended consequences here, like the workload for the farm housewife going up.
Yes, about 60%, I think it was recorded, of unpaid domestic work. And that is because if you could afford it, a farmer might have a washerwoman coming in to do the washing. And there's evidence passed around that quite a few would have let their washerwoman go and the woman of the house took up the load. But a washing machine was a time-saving device, but still, if you didn't have a pump putting water into your house, you had to get the water from the well or the river to the washing machine. They weren't plumbed in. If you did have water in the house, you still had to boil up the water and put it into the washing machine and drain it. So although it was a time-saving device, it was still labour intensive, and you were doing it instead of paying somebody to do it for you.
So there was unemployment, there was increased workload, but you also forget that it wasn't just about electrification. It allowed for running water into the house.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and that was one of the big things. James Dillon was the Minister for Agriculture in 1950, and he was speaking at the ICA's fair at the Mansion House, and he was saying again to the young ladies of Ireland, make it known that there will be no more marriages until there is hot and cold water on tap in the kitchen.
Isn't that interesting again, though, that they realised that it was women who were the agents of economic change?
Absolutely. Because you see, farmers were being focused on by the ESB initially. And it was very easy to sell electricity to a smallholder or a big farmer, because you would say, well, you could have a pump or you could feed the animals better, or you could work later because you'd have a light out in the barn. But it was then focusing on the women to get the men to bring that power into the house.
I love the priority that is attached to what it was that people wanted to run off the electricity. Yes, obviously the 100 watt bulb, thankfully the radio as well.
Yes.
But special place for the Sacred Heart.
Absolutely. Anecdotally, so I come from a family of electricians. My dad told us it, my uncle who's still alive told us, and it's recorded in numerous documents, that if you went into the house as a contractor, so the ESB brought the power to the house and then you got a contractor. Mm-hmm. But if you went into the house and you said, right, Mrs., what do you want? And they'd say, a socket for the radio and the kettle. They shared the same thing. People were very careful.
So the radio went off to boil the kettle?
Yeah, absolutely. You were interchanging. Okay. And always a Sacred Heart light.
Sacred Heart was absolutely constant. It had to be. Rosemary Hartigan, thank you very much. Your talk is one of the many, many different events taking place at Johnstown Castle Museum over the course of the coming week. Thanks for coming.
You're very welcome. Year. Thank you so much.
For the past 25 years at the Irish Raptor Research Centre in South Sligo, Lothar Muscatat has put on displays of eagles, hawks, falcons and vultures. But now he has announced that it is to close. There were up to 450 birds in the sanctuary at peak times. The good news is that he has found homes for many of his birds and is going to keep some, including a pair of breeding golden eagles. When Lorna Siggins visited him, she found him in the middle of giving a snack to a pet rook named Callie.
I'm now 3 pairs of glasses short. I don't know how many biros. And now he opened my document folder and carried documents, important documents, away. Or he ripped them into bits. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
And he destroyed a coffee machine, my computer.
One rook?
One rook, yeah. Yeah. Last year, Storm Katrina. And a lot of young birds were blown out of the nest. Most of them were badly injured or dead already. But only one was in perfect order, only very bit hypothermic. This were rook, just a handful of bird. And my partner walked through the woods there. Oh, baby! So I told her how to rear this rook, and this rook is now her darling, yeah. He's always sitting on her shoulder, he's flying after her, he's following into the house, which is not a good idea, yeah. But when he eventually destroyed my computer, yeah, within minutes, yeah, it's a laptop with a keyboard,
yes. Yeah?
Yeah, and he actually went with his beak under the keys and, yeah.
And have you been able to find a cache, like where he's hiding everything?
No, one of the glasses I found underneath the tree.
Right,
because
sometimes
he carries them up there. The smaller things he buries somewhere.
Does he? Right, and so
he likes rings, he likes things of value.
Yeah.
This rook costs a lot of nerves.
Right, yeah. So he's an intelligent bird, I suppose.
Absolutely. Oh, he's so intelligent.
Is he one of the most intelligent birds?
Yeah.
The rook.
The rooks, the corvids in general, together with some parrot species. There was research done on not the European rooks, but related species from abroad. Food was hidden somewhere which only could be reached with one long, thin tool. And the researchers left some things lying around. And this corvid-related bird actually made a tool out of timber, made it, just a long thing, to take it and poke it in and poke the food and pull it out. So we think, oh, only humans are able to make tools and think. It had to think, okay, how do I get it? I make a tool that matches this job.
So it thought about it.
Yeah.
Have you seen intelligence in other bird species then?
Oh yeah, I mean these caracaras, the one that's just flying towards us.
Yeah.
They're equally intelligent. They are called Johnny Rook on the Falkland Islands. That's where they are native to. Because they are, like the rooks, intelligent and explorative.
You came from a research background when you started
here. Yeah. No, my wife and myself worked as researchers and consultants. My wife also a teacher in a school. I lectured at the university. That was our former life in Germany. We came to Ireland originally to retire 25 years ago. We bought this place about 30 years ago. We brought a few birds of prey with us to do a little bit of research on a very small scale and private scale only, nothing big, but we thought farming only or retirement only would not really satisfy us. So we wanted to keep the brain working. I think we brought 22 birds of prey with us by that time. And then the neighbors called in and saw the birds. They were interested. And I could realize that people are fascinated by birds of prey. And in 2000, the Golden Eagle Trust launched a reintroduction program of golden eagles. And we thought, okay, why shouldn't we use our birds here to support this reintroduction program, inform people about birds of prey, win hearts for them, tell people that birds of prey are not mad killers, that they don't kill each and every lamb they see or carry babies away and whatever these stories are. It was just a snowball that was growing bigger and bigger. And in the peak time, we had more than 450 birds and animals here out of 100 different species with 14 people working here at a time. So it was kind of big enterprise. Yeah, it was never meant to be a business, and it was never a business, but it paid eventually for itself.
So a lot of children, including my own, now adults maybe, know an awful lot more about birds of prey thanks to you and your family.
Yeah, this was actually our aim. That's why we did that. As I said, winning hearts. And I mean, if we only reach 10% of these 20,000 visitors we had here per year, if these 10% did not pull the trigger or did not leave poison outside, it made a big difference. And I really hope it was more than these 10%.
While there was great sadness at last month's announcement that eagles flying was closing, Lothar has had many offers to take his birds, and he plans to rehome most of them in Ireland at several falconries and a new sanctuary planned for County Galway. He is also holding on to some of his birds, including several Himalayan vultures and a pair of golden eagles who, as he showed me, are very busy guarding a nest. So it's a treehouse.
It's quite a solid treehouse, yeah? She's in the back, sitting on the nest, obviously.
Right, so we don't want to disturb her.
No.
It would upset her if
she
went
jumps around. Up and breaks the egg or so, that would be a pity.
Oh, right, so we don't want to disturb
her. Possibly they have actually more than one egg. She's very protective. She would kill anybody who comes near.
She would
definitely kill me, or anybody else going in there. She is a very impulsive girl anyway. And now, as she is protecting the nest and possibly her egg or offspring, she wouldn't know any pardon.
Right.
And the golden eagles have massive claws, 3 inches long.
What would they go for first, your neck?
The head.
Oh, the head.
And if she grabs your head, you don't consider a pension anymore.
That's it. Your lunch. And dinner.
Yeah. But I said, that's not aggressive or vicious. They protect their babies. Yeah,
it's impressive.
That, let's say, if we keep clear in the wild from the nest of any bird, any animal, they leave us alone. they only protect themselves and their loved ones, but they would never attack for no reason.
Right, so he's flying around on a sort of sentry duty, is he?
He's flying around because he's a little bit concerned now of us.
Okay.
He is very friendly, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I used to carry him around standing on my head.
Beautiful bird, isn't he? Beautiful.
They really are stunning creatures, but my God, don't mess with the golden eagle. Lothar Muscatat and Lorna Siggins there in Sligo. That is almost it for today on the countrywide egg hunting team. Amandine hid the eggs. Dave found the eggs. Eileen Herod said that's too much chocolate and took most of it back. Sinead Mooney is on the way with your playback after the news at 9 o'clock. But before we go, last week I cooked up a little collection of the sounds of livestock and wildlife enjoying spring with a little bit of help from Vivaldi. And since we played it, we have been besieged by requests to play it again. So of course we will. Happy to oblige. But please allow us to add to it. On Easter weekend, 5 years ago, at the start of the pandemic, we played a recording made by Ella McSweeney, who's going to be in this chair next week, at the farmhouse kitchen table of the Kentucky farmer and poet Wendell Berry. It was of his poem about finding comfort in nature in uncertain times, called The Peace of Wild Things. Good morning.
When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.